So last week, kind of finished with this, right? I think I even made this statement. Who could have imagined that being cast into a pit by his very own brothers would have been step number one for the appointment to this position here in chapter 41 as essentially the prime minister of Egypt? And again, just how crazy that would have been. It's just another whatever day in prison. What's happening today? Who cares? I'm in prison. And hey, can we talk to you? Like Ricky and I were talking about this a little bit last week. What did that look like? You know, Joseph, can you come here? Oh man. Like, how many times that when you're at work is this a good conversation, or does a good conversation start this way? Hey, can I talk to you for a minute? Oh boy. Hey Joseph, we need to talk to you for a minute. Oh man. And anytime you see a prisoner let off and you never see them again, it's like, is that good because they're released, or I mean, what happened? So, Joseph, can we see you? And then they get the guy cleaned up, and the next thing you know, you're standing before Pharaoh, and yeah, well, I can't help you, but there's a God in heaven who can. Here's your dream. Here's what this means. And if I were you, Pharaoh, I would find someone that could handle it, because this is what's going to happen for the next, what? 14 years. 7 years of just rich, abundant prosperity, and then 7 years, what's going to feel like those first 7 years never existed. So you should find someone. Tag, you're it, Joseph. What? What? And all this stuff that would give him that visible authority. If you were walking around Egypt and you saw this man, you would have known who this man was. But again, it all started in that pit. So we finished in verse 44 last week when Pharaoh also said to Joseph, I am Pharaoh, and without your consent, no man may lift his hand or foot in the land of Egypt. And that brings us to verse 45 this evening. And Pharaoh called Joseph's name Zophnath-Paneah, and he gave him a wife, Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On. So Joseph went out over all the land of Egypt. I kind of like the, well, let's talk about his name first. Different renderings for his name. There's different people that, you know, have a solid understanding of the Egyptian language, and they're going to tell you that this means either treasurer of the glorious rest, whatever that meant, or it could be translated in Egyptian, savior of the age, per some different Egyptian scholars. The Hebrew form of the word, as they would have kind of translated this themselves, it was, could have been translated revealer of a secret. I like that. Another commentator said based on the hieroglyphics behind this, he was known as a wise man fleeing from pollution. A wise man fleeing from pollution. And what they would tell you is that the pollution part would have been fleeing from adultery. Like, he became known for that. Like, it would seem that at some point, everyone's like, we all know that he wasn't trying to do what he was accused of trying to do. At any rate, he gets a new name. Interesting thing that happens there for him. And I love this there again. Joseph went out over all the land of Egypt, right? He's just like, all right, I got to get to work. If we're going to save Egypt, there's work to be done. So he just starts working. It says in verse 46, Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. It's a total side note, but if you want to dig into this, look and see when Jesus Christ began his earthly ministry. And you might also look and see when King David began his kingly ministry as well. Interesting kind of a side note. So he's 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went throughout all the land of Egypt. So again, he's busy. He's moving around. He's working. 30 years old. This would be 13 years from the pit to, if you will, the pinnacle. How do we know it was that? Good question. Back in chapter 37, do you remember this? Chapter 37, verse 1 says, Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. And this is the history of Jacob, chapter 37, verse 2. Joseph, being 17 years old, feeding the flocks with his brothers, has these dreams. His brothers don't take too kindly to that and eventually, obviously, sell him into slavery. This is 13 years later. Like, well, it's just a couple of pages for us. You know, if you're reading this on your own, just at a casual pace, I don't know, is that a 5 or 10 minute kind of a span? 13 years. I think all of us want the dramatic changes in our lives, and we want what the Lord does for us, in us. We want what He does through us. We want it to be overnight. Yeah, maybe I'll dedicate 6 months or something, but nobody likes the idea of 13 years. And of those 13 years, he's a slave, he's a prisoner, and the last 2 years, he's a forgotten prisoner. 17 years started with his brothers throwing him into a pit and making the merciful decision to sell him into slavery. But again, he just gets to work. He went throughout all the land of Egypt. There's work to do. There's a nation to rescue. It says in verse 47, "Now in the 7 plentiful years, the ground brought forth abundantly. So he gathered up all the food of the 7 years which were in the land of Egypt, and laid up the food in the cities. He laid up in every city the food of the fields which surrounded them." Verse 49, "Joseph gathered very much grain as the sand of the sea." Well, how much is that? Notice the key word there, as. How much sand is that? It's beyond measure. You can't count it. It's so much. "Until he stopped counting, for it was immeasurable." Exactly as in Pharaoh's dreams. Exactly as was given to him and interpreted by Joseph that the Lord revealed to him. As we'll see in a few verses, Joseph had the foresight to build storehouses to store all of this plenty. And this is no doubt why he was all these different places throughout Egypt, making sure that as they're taxing the people, they have to have a place for all this grain, all this plenty. So they built these different things. So he was hard at work with those things. And again, all these 13 years leading up to this, all the preparation that would be necessary, that they finally get to the place like everything is just what we say in German, alles in Ordnung. Everything is in order, right? And then finally, just, it's so much grain, you can stop counting. The storehouses are basically overflowing. This is plentiful, literally beyond measure. In fact, so much so, did you catch that word there in verse 47? Some of your translations, as it says, "The ground brought forth abundantly." Some of your translations might even say, "by handfuls." Does anyone have that either as a side note or literally in the text? "The ground brought forth by handfuls." And of course, this is kind of a twofold picture for us. This would be how the reapers would, of course, collect the grain by the handfuls. You know, that's how they would do the harvesting of the crops. But it's also such a picture of, you know, their hands in the bags, their hands in the baskets. It's just hand, look at all this. Have you ever seen some? I've never seen so much grain. Never seen so much. Like the picture that it brings to my head would be someone that finds a treasure chest, you know, with like gold coins. Have you ever seen just by the handfuls? Look at all of this grain. Just blessed beyond measure. And so these storehouses that would have been necessary for this crazy amount of blessing. And again, we'll see that in a few minutes, the word storehouses, but the foresight and the faith that Joseph needed. This is a great confidence, because Joseph knew what God would do. This is what the Lord said, and this is it, right? Since he said it, how then should we act? If he's declared it, what then should we do? How then should we behave ourselves? There's going to be 7 years of plenty. I don't know. I mean, keep some in your back closet or something. You got a pantry in your, I don't know, maybe build a side pantry. Like, no, we need to get to work. And he did. "And to Joseph," verse 50, "were born 2 sons before the years of famine came," so during that first 7 years of plenty, "whom Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, bore to him." So 2 sons, his family's growing. "Joseph called the name of the firstborn Manasseh," or Manasseh, "for God has made me forget all my toil and all my father's house." And Manasseh means making forgetful. All these years into it, and all that just pain, I don't even remember it. Just all the good things that have been brought to him, it's so good. And what a blessing that is. It's so good that I can't even remember all the terrible stuff. This is still Egypt, so I'm not going to get carried away here.
But when we get to heaven, tears gone, no more sadness, no more pain. Man, I look forward to a couple other things. Of course, I look forward to being reunited with loved ones that, you know, have gone before us. I look forward to meeting Jesus face to face. Like, that's heaven. It's going to be like, hey, nice to see you again, but it's Jesus, right? Like, that's what makes heaven heaven. But I look forward to an eternity where there's no such thing as regret. You know what else is like super exciting for me? Again, Wednesdays are like just really cathartic. You know what's really exciting? In heaven, there will be no such thing as temptation. Amazing. So it will be so good that we won't, there will be nothing in us that longs for the good old days. We're not going to be in heaven going, yeah, remember the good old days back up there? That's not going to be a conversation. So good that we'll forget about the bitterness of this side of eternity. So Manasseh means making forgetful. And the name of the second he called Ephraim or Ephraim. For God has caused me to be fruitful in the land of my affliction. I recognize it's the land of my affliction, but I'm fruitful here. And Ephraim means fruitfulness. And again, just as this is how the Lord works, such blessing, such fruitfulness, even in, even through, even during affliction. And we talked about this a little bit last week, didn't we, from Romans chapter 5 and James chapter 1, that we could count it all joy when we're going through this because we know certain things to be true. And Joseph knew the presence of the Lord. But isn't this amazing how this works? As he's now married, he's now starting to have a couple kids, and this is a couple years into this time of, or as we fast forward here pretty quickly, this is going to be a couple years into now the time of famine. But during this time of plenty, he recognizes again that little phrase there, fruitful in the land of my affliction. You know, the greatest stories, secular and biblical, ancient stories and modern stories, and even our personal stories are almost always revolving around conflict or difficulty. Right? As in, when your answer is uneventful to the question of, how was your trip? How was your trip? Uneventful. And that's the end of the story. Like, I got in the car, arrived at the airport, we flew to our destination, and then I made my way to where I was going. Oh, that sounds great. And uneventful. And those are nice stories to have. But man, it's a story when, oh, was it 2 years ago, last year, whatever it was, we were coming home from Sweden and we, you know, just the extra like 7 hours we were on the airplane. And all right, well, we're not able to fly back into Chicago. I don't remember why, some storm or so we're going to take you over to Wisconsin. Okay, fine. At least we'll be able to get off the plane. Yeah, this is your part. Right? We're not going to. So we can't, no, you can't deboard. Oh, okay, so we'll just be here. I don't think we even landed. Now it's safe to go back to Chicago. And okay, we've landed, but everyone had all the same issues because of all these storms. So, like, yeah, we're number 27 in the queue here. So, and this makes for a great story sometime later, but it's always these difficult, terrible things that there's a story and there's something to learn. And there's something that would cause us to look back and say, yeah, but it was worth it. And for Joseph, the land of my affliction, and yet there's fruitfulness. An uneventful story is a non-story. So Joseph can look back on these 13 plus years and see blessing born from this place of bitterness. Oh, by the way, as an interesting genetic side note, these two boys, Manasseh and Ephraim, two of the tribes of Israel, half Egyptian, aren't they? Interesting. Interesting, the blend of Gentile blood into all of this. That's a whole fascinating side story. So verse 53 says, then the 7 years of plenty, which were in the land of Egypt, ended. And the 7 years of famine began to come, as Joseph had said. The famine was in all the lands, but in all the land of Egypt there was bread. And again, notice what happens here. Then the 7 years of plenty, which were in the land of Egypt, ended. So that was it. Like, is there anything you want to tell us about those 7 years? And kind of, can we go back to this? Well, apparently, in a word, it was uneventful. Like, any other details during... Nope, and I had a couple of kids. Oh, I got married. Congratulations. And we built those storehouses. Anything else? No, then 7 years passed, and that's what it looked like. Uneventful, but busy as they were collecting all these goods. And I love this. The 7 years of famine began to come. As Joseph had said, the famine was in all lands, but in all the land of Egypt, there was bread. So they had collected all these goods, really begins this life. In the blink of an eye, the 7 years passed, and in Egypt, there's bread. Let me say it this way. Pharaoh had the dreams, and Egypt had Joseph. And of course, Joseph had the Lord. Pharaoh had the dreams, Egypt had Joseph, and Joseph had the Lord. So verse 55, when all the land of Egypt was famished, the people cried to Pharaoh for bread. Then Pharaoh said to all the Egyptians, go to Joseph, whatever he says to you to do, do. That's our guy, right? This is who we have. The famine was over all the face of the earth, and Joseph opened all the storehouses, they're the storehouses, and sold to the Egyptians. And the famine became severe in the land of Egypt. So it's severe. It had now arrived. People are calling out to Pharaoh to help with this. The land of, or the time of plenty, the 7 years of plenty are finished. And it's extreme how bad this is. Verse 57. So all the countries came to Joseph in Egypt to buy grain because the famine, here it is again, was severe in all lands. Quick note here, and then we'll dig into chapter 42. If you would, hold your place here and turn to Psalm 105. Psalm 105 gives a great little commentary on this in the sweet songbook of Israel. Not only does it provide that, it's just some poetic language, but it also gives us a little bit more insight into the kind of the behind the scenes of all of this. Psalm 105. Yeah, we've got time. I'm going to pick it up in verse 1 and kind of read through the bulk of it. Because what happens here, Psalm 105 is a psalm that calls to mind God's past faithfulness. And man, what a helpful thing that is, and what a helpful thing to do. Call to mind what he's done. Oh, give thanks to the Lord. Call upon his name. Make known his deeds among the peoples. Sing to him. Sing psalms to him. Talk of all his wondrous works. Glory in his holy name. Let the hearts of those rejoice who seek the Lord. Seek the Lord and his strength. Seek his face evermore. Remember his marvelous works which he has done, his wonders and the judgments of his mouth. O seed of Abraham, his servant, you children of Jacob, his chosen ones. He is the Lord our God. His judgments are in all the earth. He remembers his covenant forever, the word which he commanded for 1,000 generations, the covenant which he made with Abraham and his oath to Isaac, and confirmed it to Jacob for a statute. Like, this is recounting for us the book of Genesis, right? To Israel is an everlasting covenant, saying, verse 11, to you I will give the land of Canaan as the allotment of your inheritance. When they were few in number, indeed very few, and strangers in it, when they went from one nation to another, from one kingdom to another people, he permitted no one to do them wrong. Yes, he rebuked kings for their sakes, saying, do not touch my anointed ones and do my prophets no harm. Moreover, and here in verse 16 is where we now touch on Joseph. Moreover, he called for a famine in the land. He, this is the Lord, destroyed all the provision of bread. He sent a man before them, Joseph. Whoa, that's a little bit different insight, isn't it? Well, it's his brothers, his mean old brothers. They sold him. From the eternal perspective, the Lord God himself, sent a man before them, Joseph, who was sold as a slave. Notice verse 18. Here's part of the affliction. They hurt his feet with fetters. He was laid in irons until the time that his word came to pass. The word of the Lord tested him. Until that time, the word of the Lord tested him. The king sent and released him. The ruler of the people let him go free. He made him lord of his house and ruler of all his possessions to bind his princes at his pleasure. And this is fascinating in verse 22, and teach his elders wisdom. Joseph there in the land of Egypt, one of the other things that he provided for Egypt, wisdom for the Egyptians. It wasn't just like, yeah, can you collect taxes and make sure we don't starve to death? Sure. Just him as a man of God in the presence of that people, just another corrupt nation on the planet. Joseph, I need you to be there. Again, the parallels to Daniel. Daniel, just the right person for just the right time. I need you right here, Daniel. Joseph, yeah, 13 years. It's going to get you ready. You're going to save, really, the nation. Okay.
Interesting. The savior of Egypt. Interesting to see the behind-the-scenes hand of God and plan of God at work. Chapter 42, there's your little interlude. Chapter 42 of Genesis. When Jacob saw that there was grain in Egypt, Jacob said to his sons, why do you look at one another? They're just kind of standing around, you know, like, so we're starving to death. We're over here starving. And dad's like, yeah, so you standing around isn't helping anything. You're just looking at each other. I wonder if they knew that, had they heard the same thing that dad had heard. Notice verse 2. And he said, indeed, I have heard that there's grain in Egypt. Go down to that place and buy for us there that we may live and not die. Like, hey, does anyone want to live? Yeah, that would be great. We don't want to die, right? Yeah, dad, that's okay. So we should do something about this. It's not just going to happen. Quit standing around. And again, is it possible they had heard the same things that dad had heard? Probably. And I wonder, ooh, and this leading into this big chunk of Genesis and this time for Joseph, was there ever a time when the boys, when the brothers heard the name Egypt, heard the mention of Egypt, and it did not kind of sting a little bit? Kind of that prick on their heart, just like a pinprick, like, ooh, and their mind, their memories. Egypt for them was slavery for little brother Joseph. Go to Egypt. They're probably avoiding it. Why are you guys just standing around?
We can't tell you, Dad.
Verse 3, so Joseph's 10 brothers went down to buy grain in Egypt. But Jacob did not send Joseph's brother Benjamin with his brothers, for he said, it wasn't just he's thinking it, lest some calamity befall him. Like, thanks, Dad. Don't worry about us. Like, we're, yeah, you guys go to Egypt and get grain. Okay, so you want all of us? No, I didn't say all of you. Benjamin, little Benny, you stay put. Really? Thanks, Dad. Favoritism? Yeah, a little bit. So Joseph is gone, and it seems that Jacob is not willing to lose Benjamin. This is his last link to Rachel. Perhaps, oh, by the way, and some commentators would consider it this way, is it possible that Jacob really just doesn't trust the other 10 boys? Like, I'm not sending Benjamin with you because I just don't trust you guys, you know? So is he being kind of a favoritist kind of a dad, or is he just kind of smart here? We don't know. Verse 5, and the sons of Israel went to buy grain among those who journeyed, for the famine was in all the land of Canaan. Now, based on chapter 45, we won't get there this evening, of course, but based on chapter 45, this is within the first 2 years of the time of famine. So the 7 years of plenty had happened. Now there's the 7 years of famine that have started, and this is the first 2 years of that. And it's already, as we saw at the end of chapter 41, severe. Total side note to this, but it's worth the mention, especially in the day and age in which we find ourselves. The total side note is 7 years of tribulation is going to come upon our planet. It's going to be severe from start to finish. And for the people in this part of history here in Genesis, it's only a famine. The tribulation to come, I would think they'd be longing for something as simple as only a famine. Just, can I say this? I say this a lot concerning the Gospels. You know, just casually read through the Gospels. Just casually read through the book of Revelation and then take some time and study it. But just the casual observation of what's literally going to happen, people are going to be shaking their fists against God. It will be so terrible for a full 7 years. A huge chunk of that will be the wrath of God. But the other huge chunk of that will just be us being us, as in mankind being mankind. And here's the repercussions of us being us. A total mess. But we'll fix it, right? We won't. Fortunately for us, the church, we are not appointed to wrath. And the tribulation is a time of God's wrath upon a Christ-rejecting world. There's no place for us in that, thus the rapture. So here in Genesis 42, besides the famine, besides the hunger, this trip is give or take 250 miles from where they were to go down to Egypt. And this is give or take 6 weeks. This would have also been dangerous for them to travel that far. Upon entering Egypt, when they would finally arrive, I mean, they don't know, are they actually going to be welcomed? That's great, we've heard there's grain there, but will they actually sell any to us? Of course, they knew something about traders and slavers along the way. Would that happen to us? Will we even make it to Egypt? Is Dad going to be okay for the plus or minus 12 weeks round trip while we're gone? Here's a great little snippet, side note from Warren Wiersbe. Warren Wiersbe, who just passed away, was it the beginning of this year or just last year? Great commentator, great communicator of God's word. He says this, what Jacob and his sons didn't know was that the sovereign God was at work making sure the 10 brothers went to Egypt and bowed down before Joseph. In the accomplishing of his divine purposes, God can use a famine, a kidnapping, this is 2 Kings 5, verses 2 and 3, a royal beauty contest, Esther 2, a sudden death, Ezekiel 24, verse 15, a dream, Daniel 2, a plague, Joel 1, and even a government census, Luke chapter 2, verses 1 through 7. And then Wiersbe quotes Psalm 115, verse 3, our God is in heaven, he does whatever pleases him. These guys have no idea, but that trip and their arrival must have been borderline terrifying. Now Joseph, verse 6, was governor over the land, and it was he who sold to all the people of the land, and Joseph's brothers came and bowed down before him with their faces to the earth. Cue the suspenseful music, right? Like, dun dun dun, like, and they just happen to go to this particular storehouse. Their storehouse is through all the land, and Joseph happens to be checking, right? He's got a clipboard, an Egyptian hieroglyphic. You know, how are we doing over here? Good, good, good. And the brothers just kind of arrive. No kidding, like of all the storehouses in Egypt, right? Here we are. And what are his brothers doing? Bowing to him, something about some dream all those years ago. Joseph saw his brothers and recognized them, but he acted as a stranger to them and spoke roughly, or some of your translations might say harshly to them. And then he said to them, where do you come from? And they said, from the land of Canaan to buy food. I mean, I don't know, are they there for 5 minutes? Are they there for 10 minutes? Is there a long line? Finally, they see this important government official and he's yelling at them. Oh man, this is like, at one point, let's just get out of here, let's go. But they're stuck. And here's the thing, well, notice verse 8. So Joseph recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. And kind of, why would they have recognized him? He looks like an Egyptian. And we talked about this last week, and we'll see it in these subsequent chapters. Well, actually, you see it here in this chapter. He spoke Egyptian. He didn't speak Hebrew to them. Looks like an Egyptian, sounds like an Egyptian, and with that kind of position, that kind of authority, that kind of power, there would have been not even a thought, I'm sure, that Joseph was anywhere to be found, much less this guy. Like, they're never going to think it's him. But Joseph just instantly, it's my brothers. And then, notice verse 9, then Joseph remembered the dreams which he had dreamed about them and said to them, this is where you think, hey, bros, it's me. No, not so much. You are spies. You've come to see the nakedness of the land. And the two things here, obviously, he remembers this dream and how long since he's forgotten the dream. This is another 2 years into his exile. And somewhere in his time in Egypt, again, he'd forgotten those dreams apparently. And if you remember in chapter 41, as he named his son Manasseh, it's because he'd forgotten the bitterness and the pain too. In fact, what does he say about Manasseh? Chapter 41, verse 51. Joseph called the name of the firstborn Manasseh, for God has made me forget all my toil and all my father's house. Like, this is my new life. This is my wife. These are my kids. I run Egypt.
My boss is Pharaoh, and that's I report to him, if he even cares for a report. That's my whole life. He's not even thinking about this. And then, boom! Whoa! Just the flood of memories that would have come back. And so, he's not meek and mild Joseph here. Harsh with them. Now, as we get into these next few chapters in the next week or two, it's very similar to what Jesus did with people pretty frequently in the Gospels. We saw this in a few different places in the Gospel of Mark, where there's the Syrophoenician woman that had the daughter who was demon-possessed. Oh, son of David, have mercy. And he just acts like he doesn't even hear, son of David. And the apostles, just please get out of here. And then the whole conversation, you remember this? We talked about this, I don't know, a few weeks ago. Like, would you just share some of the crumbs? It's not for the dogs to receive the bread. The bread's for the children. But could you give some of the crumbs? Even the dogs get the puppies get some bread. Like, what is Jesus doing? That seems so mean. Joseph, why are you like speaking harshly and accusing your brothers? You're spies. You've come here to see the nakedness in life. What does that mean? Like, Egypt is weak right now. We're vulnerable, and you guys are coming because maybe you're. We're just here for. So I've always got a kick out of this. And I've always wondered, why is he doing this? Short answer, he wants them to see their own hearts, and Joseph needs to see if there's any change in their hearts. Like when Jesus does that for people, he's trying to bring faith out of them. He's trying to get them to be honest about the situation, honest with him, but he already knows what's happening. He just needs them to see what's going on in their own hearts. Joseph does not have that kind of insight to his brothers' hearts. You're spies. I always kind of get a kick out of this and scratch my head all at the same time. So they said, no, no, my Lord, verse 10. But your servants have come to buy food. We are all one man's sons. We are honest men. Your servants are not spies. So is that accurate? Yeah. Is there anything else you guys would like to add to the story? But he said to them, no, but you have come to see the nakedness of the land. And they said, your servants are 12 brothers. The sons of one man in the land of Canaan, and in fact, the youngest is with our father today, and one is no more. Sort of, one is no more. They likely believed what almost certainly had to be true. All these years later, so this is 15 years later, because this is 2 years into it. If our little bro is still alive, he's living a terrible life as a slave. And I use those two words a little bit generously. Living a terrible life. Like they've just sentenced him to about the worst thing possible. And I think along with this, based on what we know about his brothers, I don't think that they ever considered that the Lord their God could be with their brother, which is probably a big part of the reason they don't recognize him. Like, that's the furthest thing from their mind. But it's also entirely possible that because of what happened to Joseph, along with all the years that had passed, well, he was as good as gone. One is no more. He is no more. I mean, what are the chances the guy's even still alive? But at the end of the day, they seem to be too embarrassed of the truth. And this was simply an easier answer to give. 12 brothers from one father. The youngest is with dad. But the other one, no, he's no more. That's all we want to say about that. Joseph doesn't relent. Verse 14, but Joseph said to them, it is as I spoke to you, saying, you are spies. Like, come on, man, drop this. You know, we got no other story here. In this manner you shall be tested. By the life of Pharaoh, and that would have got everybody's attention. This is no small charge he's placing here. By the life of Pharaoh, you shall not leave this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Okay. And then he says in verse 16, send one of you and let him bring your brother, and you shall be kept in prison that your words may be tested to see whether there is any truth in you, or else by the life of Pharaoh, surely you are spies. Oh boy. Interesting there.
especially in light of verse 17. So he put them all together in prison 3 days. So one of you can go home and get your little brother. The rest of you staying here in prison. But he puts all of them in prison for 3 days. Joseph knew all about prison. Not only from being a prisoner, from having run the prison, right? He knew what this would do. He knew what a few days in the old slammer might do for his brothers. And the tension that that would have placed on them. It's mild affliction compared to what he had endured, but they needed some of this themselves. What's that old expression? You don't know what's inside a tea bag until you put the tea bag into hot water. What flavor? You can kind of smell it, but when you really drop it into the water, now you get the full aroma. These guys needed some hot water. Then Joseph said to them, verse 18, said the third day, do this and live, for I fear God. Stop here really quickly. They knew by now that they were 100% at this man's mercy. And I wonder, though, if they would have clung to that word there, that name there, verse 18, for I fear God. You can dig into it, but the Hebrew word here, of course, is Elohim. And we're not told, as he's speaking to them through a translator, we're not told if he's saying in Egyptian, for I fear, and does he use the Egyptian word? Or does he say in Egyptian, for I fear, and then drops the Hebrew, Elohim? Either way, when the translator said, he fears Elohim, like, whoa, so how does this man know about Elohim, our God? This is this land of all these other gods. I'm curious if he used that word himself rather than just through the translator. Either way, this should have caused them some level of trust in their God. Ironic that they're being reminded about their God from this Egyptian ruler. But it also should have given them pause to fear Joseph. To pause. Like, whoa, maybe we should not fear this man. Maybe this should provide cause for us to trust him. This man, by his own admission, fears, has reverence, has respect for our God. Do this and live. I fear God. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers be confirmed or confined to your prison house, but you go and carry grain for the famine of your houses and bring your youngest brother to me, so your words will be verified and you shall not die. And they did so, or they did so. That means they agreed to this demand. One would remain in Egypt essentially as human collateral. Verse 21, then they said to one another, we are truly guilty concerning our brother. 15 years later, we're guilty concerning our brother, for we saw, notice this, we looked at this when we studied the passage some weeks ago, it doesn't read this way in the initial passage while they're doing this, but they provide the commentary. We saw the anguish of his soul when he pleaded with us, and we would not hear. They throw their brother in a pit. They're arguing about whether they should kill him or sell him to slavery, and Joseph's down in this pit begging them, please, my brothers, crying, pleading, begging with them, and we would not hear. Therefore, this distress has come upon us. We've had it coming all these years, and it finally caught up to us. Guilt will do that to you. Isn't it amazing, like, what years can do for you and what years don't do for you? Every now and then I come across these news articles about someone that's, you know, older in life, and they'll, like, send a note to a police station, or they'll send a note to a store, like a little, you know, little side business or something. You know, 40 years ago, I stole $30 from your register, and I never forgave myself for it. I never got over it. I never forgot about it. I always felt guilty. I always had this remorse, all this regret. And then I just finally, and they, like, send the money back, or they send, like, $45, because that's probably the interest and the inflation after. And they just, all these years later, I just feel so much better. It happens. I seem to read a story like that every other year or so, in different places around the planet, too. Just, someone goes to the police station, yeah, I robbed $300 from that store. Well, okay, thank you for coming in. When was this? That was 25 years ago. Why? I never got over my guilt. These brothers are guilty, and they've never been able to deal with it. And dad says, go to Egypt. Ooh, we don't want to go there. And they need this. They need this. Reuben answered them, saying, "Did I not speak to you?" Of course, right? "I told you so. Did I not speak to you, saying, 'Do not sin against the boy'? And you would not listen." Isn't that what happened? "Therefore, behold, his blood is now required of us." Reuben, I bet they thought about this basically every single day for the last 15 years. And I bet he kind of never let go of this on behalf of his brothers. He was probably still upset. And no doubt this harsh Egyptian ruler, I wonder if this harsh Egyptian ruler somehow reminded them of Joseph, but why would it? And really, it didn't need to. And he didn't need to remind them of him, because Egypt itself was a colossal reminder. Note this little blurb in verse 23, "But they did not know that Joseph understood them, for he spoke to them through an interpreter." They just assumed he's an Egyptian, he speaks Egyptian, that's it. "And he turned himself away from them and wept. And then he returned to them again and talked with them. And he took Simeon from them and bound him before their eyes." And he's going to send them on their way. But imagine seeing that. These brothers watching Simeon, of course, the second oldest, watching him be bound and led away. That's the last thing. That's your last kind of visual picture of Egypt. The oldest was, of course, Reuben, who was gone when they decided to, you know, sell him into slavery, that whole thing. But so Simeon was the oldest that was present when they sold him. I wonder if they were shocked that he's grabbing Simeon. He would have been, in those terms, the most responsible. Like, "You come with me." Like, how do they know? Interesting. Verse 25 says, "Then Joseph gave a command to fill their sacks with grain, to restore every man's money to his sack, and to give them provisions for the journey. Thus he did for them," which is now probably super weird. "You're spies. We're not. You're spies. We're, you know, brothers, and our younger brother, our dad's at home, and our other brother, he's gone. Nope, you're spies." "Well, we're not." "Okay, well, you can prove it. Go home. One of you can go home and bring back little brother, then all your own spies with us. You have to stay here." Then 3 days after, they're sitting in prison. "Okay, one of you can stay. The rest of you can go." And now, like, why is there all this stuff in our bags here? What exactly is happening? "Thus he did for them. So they loaded their donkeys with the grain and departed from there. But as one of them," we're not told which one, "as one of them opened his sack to give his donkey feed at the encampment, he saw his money. There it was in the mouth of his sack. So he said to his brothers, 'My money has been restored, and there it is in my sack.' Then their hearts failed them," which is like borderline heart attacks, right? "And they were afraid, saying to one another, 'What is this that God has done to us?'" Man, you'd like to think that their theology is a little bit, you know, in question here. But they know their own guilt. And really, because they're not in a good place spiritually with the Lord, they think that God is out to get them. It's not true. But this is what they think. Isn't that amazing, though? They assume that because there's actually provision for them. It's interesting. Like, what's the psychology behind this? What exactly is all going through their heads? "So then they went to Jacob, their father, in the land of Canaan, and told him all that had happened to them, saying..." So really, at this point, they return home and relay all that had happened. This trip, right, was anything but uneventful. "Hey guys, welcome home. How'd it go?" "Fine, here's the grain." "Okay, good." No, there are some stories. This was not uneventful. His first question, Jacob's first question as they return, is probably, "So where's Simeon?" And so here's what happened. And then Moses provides for us the rundown of them retelling the story to Dad. So verse 30, "The man who is lord of the land spoke roughly to us and took us for spies of the country. But we said to him, 'We're honest men, we're not spies. We're 12 brothers, sons of our father. One is no more, and the youngest is with our father this day in the land of Canaan.' Then the man, the lord of the country, said to us, 'By this I will know that you are honest men. Leave one of your brothers here with me. Take food for the famine of your households and be gone. And bring your youngest brother to me, so I will know that you are not spies, but that you are honest men. I will grant your brother to you, and you may trade in the land. So, Dad, this is what happened. And that's that about sums it up. So if we ever care to see Simeon again, we need to go back with Benny. That's kind of the lowdown here, Pop. So you're wondering about Simeon? Yeah, so here's the deal. And then it happened, verse 35, as they emptied their sacks, that surprisingly each man's bundle of money was in his sack. And when they and their father saw the bundles of money, they were afraid. Earlier it was just the one that opened, like, all right, time to feed the donkeys. Oh man, what's going on? Now they all, oh man. And Jacob's like, what have you guys? So Jacob, their father, said to them, you have bereaved me. You guys are killing me, right? Killing me here, guys. Joseph is no more. Simeon is no more. Or this could be translated literally. Joseph is not. Simeon is not. And you want to take Benjamin. All these things are against me. Okay, so you want to, like, okay, calm down, Jacob. Is he being kind of a drama queen here? Like, maybe a little bit, but at the same time, probably felt that way. It probably looked that way because these are the facts. Joseph is gone. He's gone. And so you guys went to Egypt to get grain and you left Simeon there. Well, this is what happened. Okay, so he's gone. And if we want to see Simeon again, we have to bring Benjamin. Thanks a lot, boys. Slow clap for his sons, right? I sent you to buy grain and you bereaved me. Thanks so much, guys. Then Reuben, this is fascinating. Then Reuben spoke to his father saying, kill my two sons if I do not bring him back to you. Put him in my hands, put Benjamin in my hands, and I will bring him back to you. Like, thanks for the nobility here, you know, Reuben, for taking responsibility. But that's not helpful. Like, killing grandkids at this point is not, like, what's the, you know, the rationale here? But again, you know, for Jacob, his limited viewpoint, his limited vantage point, this is total loss. This is total ruin. It's all over. But at the same time, we know because the Lord behind the scenes, no, that's not even close. He just could not see it yet. And Reuben, wanting to be bold and brave for Dad, and Dad, I'm going to take responsibility. I'm going to fix this. And if I, you know, we're going to take Benjamin so we can get Simeon and bring him back. And if something bad happens, I kill my two sons. Like, that, why would I? But that's, what a mess. But he, Jacob, said, my son, Benjamin, right, shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead and he is left alone. If any calamity should befall him along the way in which you go, then you would bring down my gray hair with sorrow to the grave. What is Jacob saying? No chance. Which is pretty rough if you're Simeon. Like, you're like, today it's like, hey Simeon, you're texting him. No can do, man, so Dad's not gonna, so hope to see you again. If you bump into Joseph there in prison. No chance. But Jacob just needs to see things differently. This is where it's amazing. Jacob needs to allow himself to believe that perhaps God could just maybe, I mean, okay, it's unlikely that God might do something, but maybe God might work in the midst of all this mess. I mean, this is how faith just starts. That little mustard seed of faith, that little spark of, like, okay, this is a total disaster, but God, this is a complete wreck. All these things are against me, and you want to do this, you're going to bring my gray head down to the grave and just sorrow, thanks, like, no, it's not going to happen. But I wonder what God might want to do. And of course, for us, we get to read about this all these, you know, thousands of years later. But Jacob needed to see what we get to see, though he didn't get to see it just yet. But he needed to believe that there's an end to the story. He needed to believe the whole story, believe the end from the beginning, believe that our God knows the end from the beginning. But there's not a mention of the Lord at this point. It's just, no, it's going to cost me something. No, it's too great of a cost. So absolutely not. What does he need? What is Jacob missing? Faith. And isn't this amazing? Like, this is the beginning of the nation of Israel.
just God's people, perfect all along the way, and there's never any... Dad's not even willing to send, you know, we want a rescue mission for the other son. It's going to... No. No. Sorry. Sorry, Simeon. That's it. Faith? There's none to be seen. Our vantage point is far superior. And our vantage point is far superior because not only are we on the other side of this chapter, on the other side of Genesis, we're on the other side of the cross. And our vantage point includes, we know that we're just sojourning through this side of eternity, but that side, oh, when we all get to heaven with the Lord, free from sorrow, free from death, free from pain, and in faith we can say, I know that to be so. So you've, no, I've never met God face to face. So you've, no, I've never heard his voice audibly, but I know who he is, and I know he knows me. And I know what he's promised, and I've seen his promises come to pass. I know what he's done in my heart. I know what he's done in my mind. I know how he's renewing me. I know how he's changing me. I know I'm not what I need to be. I know, but I know I'm not what I used to be. I know I used to be just racked with guilt, and I know I'm imperfect still, but I know that I'm set free. I know that I am saved. I've got eternity waiting, and man, we have the good fortune of being on this side of the cross, on this side of the resurrection, our living hope. Jacob, it's just all lost. I wonder if you're the boys like, okay, Dad, yeah, that stinks, but we're still here. Like, sorry, really, really sorry about Joseph and sorry about Simeon too, but is really everything? Thanks, Dad. Just not the greatest home life here. And oh, by the way, we'll get to it next week. The famine was severe in the land. Not going to send you. That doesn't change the famine. There's still years to go with this. Lord, we're grateful again for your word. Grateful for, well, stories that are eventful. Stories that involve fear. These brothers must have been borderline terrified. The journey itself, treacherous. Their arrival, they're welcome in Egypt, unknown to them as they're journeying. They don't know what it will look like. We do. We know. And we have this great advantage because we have the whole of your word. They were living it, walking it. This is the first book of the Bible. This is just getting started. We get to read and review and learn from it. And while we are walking our own steps, our own lives of faith, may we learn the lessons ourselves. May we make decisions to think about you, the God who is over and above eternity, not confined by it. Time is not a word that traps you, that corners you, that holds you. And what you've declared to us about eternity, we can hang our hat on that. We can have and should have this great confidence that we're going to make it because of you. Just again, as you were with Joseph during that affliction, you are with us. Even when we would commiserate with Jacob, it just seems like a total loss. But God. Everything's against me right now, but God. I'm going to go to my grave in sorrow, but God. So may we look to what we know to be true based on what you have declared to us. Holy Spirit, would you grant that extra measure of faith inside of us? Not only for our own sakes, but just as we read from Psalm 105, as Joseph was also a blessing to the elders there in Egypt, that by our faith we might also be a blessing and an example, that doors might be opened for the gospel to those around us that want nothing to do with you, at least now. And may they see how we live, and may that be a challenge to them. Use us, Lord, please. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, God bless you guys. Have a great night. Hope to see you Sunday.